When theatre voice critics reviewed O'Neill Theampro Jones, then at the Gate Theatre in 2005, there was unanimous agreement that the production could not possibly transfer, so particular was the staging. We were proved wrong when it took to the Olivier stage last month. Instead of a stockade into which a mere 64 people gazed to watch the psychological disintegration of Brutus Jones, 1,100 observed a spectacle on a different scale. But one very important component remained the same. Patterson Joseph is still Emperor Jones. And I'm pleased to say that he has joined me, Heather Neal, here now at the National Theatre to talk about the production. Well, Patterson, let's go back to even before the first manifestation of this production, when Theus Sherrick, the director, asked you to do it. I believe you had some misgivings, although you knew the play quite well, I think.
That's right. My history, really, with the play starts in around 1982. And I was at a drama school run by an elderly American called Robert Henderson. And Robert gave me this play and said that there would be some good audition pieces in it for me. So I took the first scene when Brutus is in the forest, and that was my audition speech. And subsequently, when I went to Lambda, I did that for them and got in. It was a great speech, actually. It was a great speech to do because it's physical, but it's also emotional and funny, and it's only a couple of minutes long. So that's what I knew of it, and I was about 19 or so then. And when Theo approached me years later, 2005, in fact, oh gosh, that's 20. I can't believe it's 23 years later. Anyway, I was shocked by it. I finally properly, you know, sort of, well, not properly, but read it as a 40-year-old. I just thought, you can't do this now. The N-word is littered in this piece. Some of the descriptions are really, it's on the edge of racist. I mean, what is this play saying? So I took it away, I thought about it, and the more I read it, the more I liked it. The more I liked it as a psychological study of a dictator, a psychological study of a man who is sort of reaching for a status that he doesn't feel like he naturally has. And it's the oppressed man who becomes the oppressor, and so many echoes of that in society. And I just thought, this is a prophetic play about what, you know, what dictators after sort of 1920 did. Stalin, thinking of Hitler, Idi Amin, and other dictators, both in Africa and in the West. And I thought, this deserves a showing. This deserves to be put on. We deserve to see O'Neill's play put on as it was meant to be put on. So, you know, we took the...
It's because it was 1920, wasn't it?
1920, so you're talking about a 90-odd-year-old play here, yes. And it hasn't been done in this country for years.
Yeah.
The trouble, of course, with it is that people who read the play find it racist, because they see the phonetics, and it's written phonetically, and they say, well, this is just garbled speech. This is minstrel speak. This is not how black people speak. This is ridiculous. But the minute you put it in your mouth and you see those D-E's as the, and you see the H-A apostrophe N-T-S as haunts, you begin to see that O'Neill's ear for Jones's language is perfect. It's pitch perfect. I don't change any of the lines. I don't change any of the way I speak. But modern Americans come to see it and they say, are you American? And these are black Americans, they're African Americans. Are you American? Where are you from in the States? Now, it's because I've been very true to O'Neill's writing that it's right and authentic. And, of course, when he was writing this play, he researched it. His lead actor, Charles S. Gilpin, who he said was the greatest actor he'd ever worked with. And as an actor, I think that might be because he gave him some of those lines or gave him ways of saying things. And barmen and sailors who he worked with in Honduras and other places. So what you have is an authentic African-American figure.
Gilpin, of course, was black.
Gilpin was black.
Yeah.
And when we think about that, too, when you look at the play and you say, is it a racist play written by an Irish-American? How could it possibly be? This is the first African-American lead role in a drama. It's not a song and dance routine. This is a drama. And he's a black man without blackface. Now, strangely, they had white men playing black men with blackface, but they also had black men playing black men with blackface. So you couldn't tell. How extraordinary is that? But that's the state of play 1920. So here's this character, who's not a nice man, not a nice servant. He is a powerful dictator who crushes a white man before our eyes, insults him, dominates him. And then we see his disintegration. Now, is this disintegration about him getting back to who he really is and not being uppity? No. It's about what happens to a man who structures his life around fear and intimidation, who structures his power around making people frightened of him. And that can be said of any race, in any country. And I think O'Neill used Jones because he knew that he could bring out some very powerful images and some very powerful music and dance in a way that you couldn't have done if it was perhaps a Jewish character or an Irish American character. So I love the play. I'm a great advocate of it too.
But do you nevertheless find it difficult to say the N-word? And have you had reactions from people, whether black or not, about saying it?
I have an issue with the word generally. I mean, I think that the word is used by rappers to describe other black people and themselves in order to empower themselves in some way. But I personally don't think that that always works. I think it can sometimes backfire. In this play, however, it's not thrown away. When you think about the use of the word, if you just look at it chronologically, it starts off being used by the white man. Immediate shock from the audience. What have we come to watch? This could be awful. Which is fantastic, of course. The next person who comes out uses it, but he is a black man. He uses it against the people that he is oppressing. Terrible. It's even worse. What are we supposed to think? It's fantastic. You can feel this ripple in the audience.
And it isn't just once. It's I don't know how many, several dozen times.
Well, somebody, of course, counted them. And I think that Guardian blog that was very sort of famously started a week or so ago lists how many times. But the interesting thing is, eventually, he starts to use it of himself, calls himself that. He's not being pejorative at that time. He's just saying it. It's just a casual thing that comes out of his mouth. But we notice it because we've seen how that word has been used. And eventually, he stops using it, stops addressing himself in that way. And it's a very interesting use of that word that O'Neill has, and a very pointed use of it, which I think legitimizes its use, if you like. Mm. There's a great groundswell in America at the moment against that word, the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Coloured People have tried to ban it in music, have asked several rappers to stop using the word, and a couple of them have said they would. There was a conference recently where a black comedian got up and started using the word, and he was cut off. And so it's the great groundswell of anti the word being used even by black people. That makes the play, I think, even more poignant for today.
Well, having played it at the Gate in a very small but intense space where everyone was looking down at you, and we had a very different, as audience, a very different relationship with the actors.
Yes.
You've now moved to the Olivier, a stage which you say you love, and many actors do not love the Olivier. So what is it about the Olivier that you love?
I haven't always loved the Olivier. When I first came to the National, I was at the Littleton, a theatre that I found fine. I had no problem with it.
And that was in?
It was in a play called Whale. And it was a fantastic piece, actually, written, I believe, by David Holman. About whales trapped in the ice in the Arctic. That was in 1988. And then when I came back, about 4 years later, I did The Recruiting Officer that Nick Heitner directed in the Olivier. And I think I probably had the worst time of my life in any theatre. First of all, I just couldn't reconcile myself with the vastness of it. and how large the performances needed to be, when my character, Mr. Worthy, I felt was sort of a very ordinary person and should be Mr. Everyman. And my opposite number, you know, my rival was Des Barrett. Say no more. So it was little and large. It was, I couldn't get there, and it was my own fault, but the proscenium arch thing that I felt was going on too restricted me, and I sort of lost faith in myself, and perhaps a bit in the space. Years later, I came back and I did the Elmina's Kitchen in the Cottesloe. That was 2003. And then the invitation came to do The Royal Hunt of the Sun. Now, the part was wonderful. I just thought, there's no two ways about it. I'd do this play in a barn. I'd do this play at Heathrow Airport. I don't care. This is an amazing role, and I must do it, and I must take the bull by the horns. And I found myself loving the space, because the space likes grandeur. The space enjoys words. The space enjoys power. You can be quite intimate, actually, funnily enough, in that space, once you've learnt its parameters. As long as you give it enough power and enough energy and love the space and don't shy away from it or fight it, you can be quite intimate in that space, as long as you're accurate. And I loved playing Atahualpa, and I miss him still. I think he was a lovely person. And because of this £10 season thing of not having a lot of set, you are the actor with the audience in that space, and that's, to me, the best relationship you can have. You get it in small theatres automatically, because the audience can see the whites of your eyes, literally, can see you sweating. Whereas in the Olivier, you have to project a little bit more in order to get that. But when there isn't a lot going on around you, it's you. The audience is watching you, and they're very focused. And so you can be very natural. And I loved it. I loved it. And so doing the Emperor Jones there, well, of course, when I first got the phone call, Thea said, look, I've got this thing to tell you. And I said, look, I don't think I can do it, because I'm already doing St. Joan with Marianne Elliott, and I won't be available.
Yes, in which you play Cochon, the bishop. Political bishop.
That's
yes.
Right. Well, he's specifically not a political okay. bishop. He'd be very angry to hear you
all
say
right.
that. The man of passion, the man of faith. The thing I said to her was that I can't do it. I won't be able to. I'm there till September. She went, no, it's fine, because this is going to be at the National. I thought, wow, in the Cottesloe, that's going to be great. She went, no, the Littleton. Wow, I don't know how we're going to do it in there. It's going to be so different. Not the Littleton. I couldn't believe it. I think I swore, and I had that conversation with many friends of mine who asked me what I was doing, and I told them, surely it's this or surely it's that. No, it's the Olivia. But we both said, you know, we needed to do, and this is the phrase I keep using sort of quite often, I suppose, because you have to be brave in that space. We had to take the bull by the horns again and say, this is not a small play. It wasn't written for a small theatre. And we both said, I think it's been reported elsewhere, during the rehearsal at the gate, we said, you could only do this play in a really tiny theatre, or a really big theatre, like the Olivier. We sort of threw away, and it came back to haunt us. But it does fit. And in fact, I think, it's a vast play, and it's about one man as well against the world. And
But did you have to rethink your performance? Obviously, it's physically very different, isn't
yes.
it? But... And the relationship with the audience has got to be different. You have to go out towards them in a different sort of way, I imagine.
Yeah. I mean, rather embarrassedly, some sub-editor put in one of my reviews, one of my interviews, the headline, I'm too big for TV.
Yes, I saw
which,
that.
Honestly,
I understood what you meant.
Yes, exactly. Well, my agent called me and said, what are you saying?
Do you never want to work again?
What are you doing? Yes. But the context was basically that I like full emotions. I like to express them, and I have a very sort of big voice, and I use my body and I use my eyes. And so I even in the gate, you know, I wasn't thinking, we're in a small space, so I'll do it in a small way. I expressed myself as I would in almost any space. Didn't need as much voice, of course. But that was, in some ways, about the only difference, is how much you have to project. That's all, really. psychologically, we wanted to keep it exactly the same. We wanted to keep the same sense of the journey that he goes on. And we also wanted to keep the sense that he was talking to himself. And so whilst I obviously give more out, because I can sort of look up and must look up to the audience can see what I'm doing and thinking, it is still quite intimate, I think.
Yes, although you do get more of a sense of the context of this figure.
Yes.
Rather than being inside his brain, almost as we felt we were at the gate.
That's right, and that's the advantage. We both knew that that was going to be the advantage of doing it in the Olivier, that you can't take away from people the experience they had in the gate of being inside my head, and I can't take away from myself the memory of being able to think something, speak it, and know that the audience get it just like that. But the vastness of the world that he's entering into, this, in fact, the world that he's created, but also the world that he runs into, the forest, the spirits, his imagination, his past, his learnt past. This is not his actual past, not his personal past. This is sort of race past, racial history, if you like.
The history of slavery.
The history of slavery and auctions and being on the boat and actually something even before that. Something even before that happens to him during this play. You need a big stage, in fact, to truly show all of that, as opposed to it just being in his head, just his thoughts. So
I suppose we should say a little bit about the plot, as if you can call it a plot. It starts off in quite a naturalistic kind of way, doesn't it? First scene is.
Yeah.
And we discover that this person is a criminal, really, who has come from America, but he has pronounced himself emperor of an island in the West Indies.
Yes.
And he's treated everyone very badly, and so they are deciding not to put up with it anymore.
Yeah.
And he runs away.
That's the gist, isn't it?
And his disintegration is the main part of the play.
That's right.
Because so much of it is then becomes expressionistic and it goes on in his head.
Yes, yes.
Some of it is real and some of it isn't.
That's right. I mean, obviously, to Jones, all of it is real.
Yes.
And what's interesting about what O'Neill started writing, I mean, he wrote this very quickly. He said he wrote it in 10 days. It's one of those plays that he almost rushed out, didn't revisit or revise very much because it was perfect in his eyes.
It was only the second play he wrote, wasn't it?
Yeah, extraordinary.
He was over 30, I think. But
I think he was in his 20s,
actually. Oh, was he? Yeah.
I think he was in his 20s. He was very young. Yeah, it starts off very naturalistically, as you say, Heather, and it ends up being very expressionistic. But it's almost as if what he's trying to say is, this is the natural world that we inhabit and that we live in, that we construct our hierarchies in. What happens when all that's stripped away? What happens when the colonial power who's oppressed the people suddenly becomes subject to the same things that the people are subject to, but doesn't understand it and is actually antagonistic towards it? What can happen in those cases? And that's what you see, is a sort of dismantling of I suppose of a Western man, and it becomes more basic. But that is not pejorative and negative to say that.
No, in a sense that isn't racist at all, is it? Because it's about what happens to anyone who takes power who is not able really to wield it.
Well, you can look at Macbeth. I mean, I don't think anybody would argue that Macbeth is a racist play against the Scots. Yes, he could have made him British, but he didn't. He made him English. He could have made him Welsh, but he didn't. He made him Scots. But that's because it suited what he wanted to do. That's what he suited something.
And
that,
a Scottish king as well, so it helped, didn't it?
Well, yes, indeed. I think that's really important, actually, to say that at the end of the play, when Africa comes to the West, and that's really what happens in my eyes and in Thea's eyes. This is not, oh, voodoo, dark, black magic, awful, and this poor Christian man has been subjected to these awful demonic spirits. That isn't what O'Neill is saying. What he's saying is, the island needs purifying from this destructive influence. And the way that this purification needs to happen is that Jones needs to sacrifice himself to, if you like, the gods of the island, this other spirituality that he has rejected and mocked and ridiculed. And I think that's very powerful. And I think it is beyond race then, because it becomes about human spirituality, and it becomes about What is it that we believe in spiritually? Do we believe in the spirit? Or are we just flesh and blood and bone and genes? Is that all we are? Or is there something more to us? So I think the play goes out there, starting off as a sort of almost domestic drama. It goes into this almost esoteric world, and I think it's marvellous. And couldn't be written today. Couldn't possibly be written today.
Not just because of the language?
Partly because of the language, definitely because of the race, and mainly because of the mindset. It's somebody saying, I will go from naturalistic to this strange place of spirit. I don't know that there are many plays today, written today, that are as brave about it as that.
Yeah. Of course, it's something of the journey of Othello, although he is a hero to begin with.
Yes.
But he does strip away as well and return to something, a state before he became the hero of Venice, in the final scene. And you've played Othello, haven't you?
I have.
Is that something you want to do again? Because you were quite young when you did it. You've got room for another one, haven't you?
I do have a room for another one. I'd love to do it again. I want to do it again. And I'd love to play Othello again. And I've cheekily said that I'd love to play Iago too, and I would. But Othello, to me, is about culture. And it's always been about culture, actually, ever since I read it when I was 19 or so. I thought that it is not so much about the stupid black man and the smart white man. This is much more, or it should be, if it's ever played properly. This is my thinking then. It should be much more about, first of all, two soldiers who would die for each other and have perhaps died at Rhodes, protected each other to the point of almost death at Rhodes, Cyprus, and on other grounds, Christian and heathen, as they say. So they trust each other. So one man saying to another, I see your wife with, oh, I can't tell you. What, you must tell me, has a deeper resonance than simply white and black sophistication against lack of sophistication. So it's about culture. The Eastern culture of trust, the Eastern culture of openness, of what you see is what you get, of honour, which can sometimes make people a bit brittle and a little bit narrow-minded in some other aspects. But it is a beautiful thing that Othello has. I trust her. I trust him. If he's saying there's something wrong, there must be something wrong, even though I trust her, which is where the beginning of his madness is.
Yeah.
And Iago, of course, is the sophisticated Westerner who has all sorts of serpentine qualities and doesn't trust anybody and knows how to undermine the man who trusts like a fool.
Yeah.
Will be led by the nose, as he says,
yeah.
You know. And that, to me, is the important question of Othello, is what happens to him at that point? Well, his Eastern mind says, she's right. And what he's learned from the West is, or what he's learning from Iago about the West is, no, there's black and white, there are shades of grey, and this is enough to send him off the deep end. Yeah.
Is when you prepare, obviously, you think very deeply about the psychology of your character. Do you read as well? Do you research? Is that something you do?
Yes.
You obviously have to prepare physically as well, I imagine, especially for Emperor Jones. You're on the stage all the time, running about.
I am, running and bumping into several things. I haven't hurt myself too badly. I've got sort of the usual aches and pains, but not too badly. I won't be... My wife's saying, in 5 years' time... You know that if anybody ever offers you to do this again, you can't do it. I said, yes, I promise. I tend to do as much research as I need to and try not to overburden myself with too many ideas.
Yes, because the Emperor Jones is said to be possibly based on Henri Christophe of Haiti. Early 19th century soi-disant emperor.
That's right. He was the sort of second after Toussaint Louverture. And he declared himself, emperor of the island and committed suicide, possibly with a silver bullet.
Yes.
Yeah. As did President Sam, who was, early 20th century dictator of Haiti. So that thread runs through. So I did a little bit of that. I mean, it didn't matter to some extent. What the history was.
It's just an extra knowing that,
it,
really.
It is. It just sort of helps sort of bolster it, and it's not, you're not basing it on just what the writer has written, which I think actually is legitimate. You can base things completely on what the writer has written and not read Wuthering Heights if you're doing it as a movie. You know, sometimes it's wisest not to, because then as an actor you go, well, this section, which is really important because it sort of explains my character, is missing. Well, you don't need it. You know, if the writer has written something that is full enough. So I do a fair deal of research. I mean, most of the research I did on Jones was about its first performances and the reaction from the Harlem Renaissance writers and intellectuals at the time, and the audience and the critics.
And Robeson played it later, didn't he?
Robeson played it, yes. Robeson played it on Broadway. I think by that point Charles Gilpin was going through several problems, but Robeson was becoming a star. But
that was still in the 20s, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was like late 20s. Mm. And then eventually a movie was made in 1933, I believe, with Robeson. I haven't seen the movie, and I'll only see it, I think, when I stop doing Jones. And it goes back into his past, and as most movies tend to do, they don't stick slavishly to the play and to the timescale of the play. They actually go back into his past as a Pullman porter and girlfriends and church.
Well,
and
that seems that. Rather a shame.
I would say so, but I can't judge until I've seen
it. No, I haven't seen it either. But, Now, I believe you said that the first time you went into a theatre, you were actually in the play. So, and I know you're interested in bringing other people in. You were involved in a project, weren't you, in Harlesden, where you grew up? Would you like to say something about that? It was Romeo and Juliet, wasn't it?
That's right, yes. I was asked by a production company whether I would direct something, and I said, yes, what? And they said, well, we had several play ideas, Shakespeare play ideas, but what Shakespeare play would you do, and where would you do it? Somewhere you grew up, or? And I thought, well, I really didn't like being in Harlesden. I went to school there. I lived in Willesden, but I went to school in Harlesden. I really didn't like it. I found it quite rough, and I always felt very tense around there. But I thought, you know what? We have such a bad opinion of inner city London. What about doing Romeo and Juliet, for example? And so they said, yes, okay. And we happen to have Baz Luhrmann here, who will be your mentor from Australia. Well, I said, yes, of course, I'd do it. I had 4 weeks to rehearse untrained actors, ranging from 17 to 52. And it was the best experience of my life by a long way. It was wonderful.
That's an amazing thing to say, given what you're doing now.
Well, in terms of theatre life, it taught me a lot about myself, because these children were like me. And so that was invaluable. It taught me a lot about the power of Shakespeare. People will theorise about it, but actually, he is powerful. He can change lives. And I'm an advocate of it because I know. I've seen it. I've seen it happen to me, and I saw it happen to these kids. I mean, by the end, kids who would not even look me in the eye or say to me what they thought about Shakespeare were then giving their opinion on the RSC's Romeo and Juliet, to which they said they didn't commit. They didn't commit to the text. They didn't commit to the emotions, which, you know, they were having such problems with. But of course, they could, having gone through it, could see what it was that was needed. I'm not saying anything about that production. That was their opinion. But what was powerful about it was seeing them grow. And some of them said at the end, this is the first time I've ever finished anything. And that, to me, was magical. And so, of course, yes, it was the greatest experience of my life in the theatre, and I will never forget it.
So might you do something similar again?
If I'm ever funded properly, and if ever I have the opportunity, I would do it in a flash. I wouldn't hesitate. Jonathan Taylor, who played Romeo for me, is in The Emperor Jones. He was in it at the gate, and he's in it here. And he plays Jeff, the vision of the Pullman Porter. And I love having him around. I mean, he does various other things in the play as well, but he's a great soul. And having been through what he's been through, you know, being knifed almost to death at 14, to being on the Olivier stage, he appreciates it, and I appreciate having him there. Mm. It's a great honour, really, to have him around.
So there's someone you've obviously introduced to professional theatre. What about you? How did you get the idea for it if you never went to see anything?
Well, I was academically not brilliant. I mean, I could read quite early on, but my interest...
I don't think that's very easy to believe, actually.
No, but it is. It's true. Academically, I was just useless. I couldn't really... I wasn't great at... my handwriting was terrible, so it always looked like I didn't know what I was doing, although, you know, my vocabulary was quite good. I listened to the radio a lot. And I had, numerically, just a blind spot, just terrible with numbers. And so I didn't pass my 11 plus. I went to a bog standard comprehensive in Harleston, and I hated it. And I bunked off, really, for a lot of the time. But I went to the library and read. And it was reading, really, that led me think, I do have an intelligence. I am not stupid. That helped me, because I could read these things and put myself in Narnia. You know, it was the first book I remember being sort of shocked by the sort of colour of it that was coming out of this page. I was no longer in Willesden Green. I was looking at the Snow Queen and eating Turkish Delight with Edmund, you know. And to me, that was magical. You could do that. The next time that happened to me, I was a chef and I wanted to do something else because I knew I couldn't work in a kitchen. It was just driving me insane, those four walls. And those huge oars that we used to stir the porridge in at the Royal Free Hospital in Hampstead. And so I needed to get out. And I had an address for a youth theatre, the Cockpit in Marylebone, which was run by then the Inner London Education Authority. So they gave a lot of money for theatre and education and some great teachers and great writers. And they would write for the youth theatre there. And so I went there. And I remember the first day I went, I was about 18 at that point, seeing these 15 and 16-year-olds so confident, so eloquent, and I just thought, I'm not that. I'm really, really shy. I can barely look people in the eye. This is terrible. I want what they've got. We were ushered into a room, and I was asked to improvise something with a partner, and I didn't know what to do. My dad was a plasterer, so I thought, let's build a wall. So I built a wall with this fella, and I just remember this sort of ripple of comprehension coming from the audience, this ripple of acknowledgement of what we were doing. And we made up words and stuff, and people laughed. And I just thought, this is magical. This is just as magical as the Narnia thing. I am from Willesden Green. I don't know how to build a wall. I'm pretending to do it, but they're believing that I'm doing it. That's magic. And only human beings can do that. I don't know any animal in the animal kingdom who can do that. And it's so wonderful. It's such a gift that it was a gift to my life that I thought I want to do that for the rest of my life. This is what I want to do. And that's what started it off. And so at the Cockpit, I did my first play, written by Clive Barker, who's now a horror writer, called Subtle Bodies, about Edward Lear. Strange play. And I played this sort of drunk from Manchester. I'd never done a Manchester accent, but I looked at Coronation Street and I did one. People were asking me whether I was from Manchester. And I sort of thought, oh, I've got a facility for accents, I must really kind of hone that, you know. And so that was it. Yeah, the first time I was in the theatre, I was in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic. I mean, to understand the magic of it and to keep that is so important.
And I still have it. And I still have that.
It's, you get it in the theatre so much more than you do on anything on the screen, don't you?
Listen, I don't think there's any comparison. I think you can go to the cinema and suspend your disbelief, but you don't have to suspend your disbelief that much, because everything you're shown is, in inverted commas, factual. Mm. Okay, there might be fantasy worlds, but they have a sort
It's done for you.
Yeah, that's right. You're told what to watch, you're told what to listen to, and you're given the pace of it. Your heartbeat is set by the music or by the action. Whereas in the theatre, it's a human transaction. Mm. It's me and you sitting here, you know, Heather, it's live, it's visceral, and it's really very dangerous, because anything could happen.
Yes, you know. And you're in complete control when you're on that stage.
You think you are. you sort of fool yourself. I wasn't thinking about this too much, because otherwise it'll be like driving a car and going, how come I know how to do this, and crashing. But there is a kind of suspension in the actor too. You know, he has to pretend that he will remember every single word that's about to come. And that's what, you know, you get stage fright, you know, that moment, that black hole that we can all find, we mustn't, but we can all find that goes, you don't know what you're going to say next.
Yeah.
And all actors have gone through that moment.
Yeah.
It's only ever happened to me once. And that was with a stage fright. I was about to do Hotspur for the Old Vic. I was about to go and kill, I thought, Hal, Sam West, and just about to go on, and I thought, what's the first move? What's the first move? And I stepped back and I went, shh, don't think about it. It will come to you. And I jumped on. There was this moment's hesitation.
Feet tell you where to
and
go.
Then your feet and your hands do it.
Yeah.
And that it was my only experience of that horrible black hole. But that's what's magical about theatre.
But that's brilliant that you could control it like that. Because there are actors who have stopped at that point and had a terrible gap of maybe years.
I know. Well, maybe. Maybe I'm just blessed with a kind of vacuousness in a certain area of my brain, which I will cling to for the rest of my life.
You have done a lot of television, of course, including Green Wing and
that's right.
Lots of things that people will know you for.
Mm.
But, and I imagine you do want to do television again, despite...
That headline was just, I must get hold of that sub-editor and pound them into the dust. That's a lie, it's a lie. No, I'm not too big for TV in that sense. I love it. I love it. I think it's a really powerful medium, and I the best things I've done on TV have been character parts. Mm. You know, I did a thing called Jekyll for the BBC, where I was an African American heavy, really, quite quick witted, smart mouthed, and pretty nasty, and I loved that character. It's a larger than life character. I loved the character on Peep Show. That I do for Channel 4, because he's a horrible loans manager with leather driving gloves who drives a BMW and has a terrible tash and thinks he's wonderful. But that's a great larger-than-life character, so I love those.
Do you ever have trouble extricating yourself from characters? I mean, can you leave Emperor Jones in the theatre? Does he go home with you?
Yeah, I suppose because they're so extraordinary, so off-centre, that they are easy to get rid of, really, those characters. I mean, I don't speak like him. I don't think like him at all. I have very little to do with him. We share a race, but that's about it. Mm. And I think... I say that, but sort of more and more towards the end of the play, if you like, he becomes more of an everyman, I think.
Interestingly.
So I think he's less the character he's put on himself. Mm. And then it does become closer to not me, but something closer to it, to... an ordinary human being, which I am, of course. And I debrief, you know, I do a silly thing in my head and I say who I am before I go on for the curtain call, so I can smile and be myself rather than a traumatised person or, you know, a guilty person, if it's in the case of Pierre Corchon. The not political Bishop of Beauvais.
Okay. Yes, he does suffer.
He does indeed. His body certainly suffers.
Yeah.
Yeah, he gets excommunicated, doesn't he, and thrown in a sewer. Not a great ending.
No. Well, I think I better let you go. Actually, we've talked for such a long time.
Well, I don't need to warm up now. I can just go straight outside, just nearly the half. Thank you very much for that, Heather.
Well, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
We should say that if people want to find out about how to get tickets and anything else they want to know about the production, the National Theatre website, which is just nationaltheatre.org.uk, has now got nice bits of video and all sorts of things on it.
That's right, yes.
But also the phone number is 0207452 3000.
And it's the Travelex season.
And it's the Travelex
season. The tickets are
£10.
Yeah. And the play is 70 beautiful minutes long.
Thank you very much, passengers.
Thank you.